Francesca manages the strategic aspects of the 2030 Challenge for products and coordinates collaborative efforts with leaders in the field. Additionally, Francesca supports other Architecture 2030 activities through in-depth and technical research and analysis. Francesca?
Great. Thank you, Gary. So as Gary mentioned, my name is Francesca, and I'm going to be talking today about the 2030 Challenge for Products, which is an initiative from Architecture 2030 to decarbonize building products. Now, before I jump into products, I want to take a step back and look at the building sector as a whole. We spend 90% of our time in buildings. And this number seems large, but it makes sense. Whether we're at work or at home or on vacation in various hotels and such, 90% of our time is spent in buildings. And we expect these buildings to be comfortable. When it's hot outside, you want them to be air-conditioned. When it's cold outside, you want them to be heated. And you expect electricity at the flip of a switch and any time you plug in an appliance. So the result of that is that buildings consume 49% of U.S. energy. And since most of our energy comes from the burning of fossil fuels, the building sector is also responsible and contributes about 47%, again, almost half of all of the U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. And these numbers are on an annual basis. So these greenhouse gases are accumulating in our atmosphere, warming our planet, and putting our infrastructure, our communities, and our buildings at risk from such things as drought, disruptions to food and water supply, more intense and frequent storms, rising sea levels, increased forest fires, and the spread of disease to new areas. So our mission at 2030 is to reduce these risks and to transform the building sector from really the key contributor to climate change to a central part of the solution. And we do this through the design of energy-efficient and resilient buildings, cities, and products as well, which I'll get into. So our three main initiatives that we use to achieve this mission are at the three scales of the building sector, again, at the city scale with the 2030 Challenge for Planning, at the building scale with the original 2030 Challenge, which we launched in 2006, and then with the 2030 Challenge for Products, which is what I am going to particularly talk about today. So if we look at a pie chart of energy consumption in the building, in the U.S., you can see the yellow section is the building sector. So, again, about half of the U.S.'s total annual energy is consumed by buildings. The majority of this energy consumption comes from building operations. That's the larger piece of the pie, and that's the heating, cooling, lighting of buildings. But there's also this other piece that is the products and constructing these buildings. And on an annual basis, this represents about 4 to 6% of total U.S. energy consumption. So this is not a small amount. And in fact, when we look at an individual building, we can see that this impact is even greater. On the first day that a building is occupied, 100% of the embodied energy and the associated greenhouse gases that building consumes, 100% is related to building products. That's the initial investment in building that building. And then over the life of the building as it's operated, you can see the relationship you'd expect with the majority of the energy consumption and the greenhouse gases being attributed to the building operation, and then about a quarter of the energy consumption being related to the, again, that initial energy investment in building the building. But what's really interesting is the short term. We're serious about transforming the building sector by the year 2030 to begin to reduce those serious risks of climate change, then we need to start acting now. And for any new buildings built today or any major renovations, the products are actually much more significant, representing about, from now until 2030, they represent about half of the energy consumed by that building. So the choices that we make, the products that we use in all of our new buildings is highly significant. So for this reason, we launched the 2030 Challenge for Products, It's a complementary challenge to all of our other challenges, and again, focuses on that small scale of the individual products that go into a building. And it's a global challenge to specify building products that meet a reduction in their carbon footprint. The reduction is initially set at 30%, and then it incrementally increases throughout the years, building up to a 50% reduction by the year 2030. And this, again, is a reduction from an average or baseline for a building a product category. I'll get into that a little bit later. So there are four main steps to achieving the 2030 challenge for products. The first step is to calculate. We need to understand what the impact of a product is and be able to compare it to that benchmark and other products. The next step is to communicate this information to specifiers, architects, contractors, all of the consumers of these building products. And then taking all of that information, specifiers, in the third step, we'll need to specify low-carbon products that meet the 2030 challenge reduction targets. And then finally, use these specifications to drive purchasing preferences for low-carbon building products. So starting with the first step, what is a carbon footprint and how do you calculate it? A carbon footprint is the sum of all of the greenhouse gases emitted over the life of the product. In a broad term, it represents the impact from manufacturing and using the product. It's measured in kilograms CO2 equivalent per a unit, for example, per meter squared of carpet or per kilograms of concrete. And the most important thing to keep in mind as I go through the next few steps is that this carbon footprint and how you calculate it, the result needs to be comparable. In order to make informed decisions about whether a product is low carbon or whether it meets the reduction, it's really, really critical that the carbon footprints for building products are comparable across products within that category. So the most basic way to calculate a carbon footprint is what's called a life cycle assessment, or an LCA. And this is really analysis of that product over its entire life, starting with the extraction of the raw resources, the transportation of these resources to a manufacturing plant, the manufacturing of the product, the transportation to the construction site, the construction and installation of the product, its use over the life of the building, and then finally its end-of-life scenario or how it's disposed of and whether it's, you know, just trash or whether parts or all of it are recycled and put back into the system. So an LCA is a really great place to start. It helps the manufacturer begin to understand their total impact of that product, and critically, it helps identify what are called hotspots or areas in which there's particularly large impact from that product. And by understanding and targeting these hotspots, manufacturers can not only realize carbon reductions and reduce their carbon footprint, but they can also often realize cost savings and efficiencies in either supply chains or new materials, and it also is an opportunity to push innovation at these specific spots. Some more technical information about LCAs. They follow a set of international standards from ISO, and within these standards, the carbon footprint is what's technically referred to as a global warming impact. But the LCA can also measure other impacts, such as acidification, ozone, eutrophication, and then photochemical ozone creation. So not only are you getting that carbon footprint, again, that global warming impact, but you can also get sort of a more holistic look at the environmental impacts of this product. But an LCA is sort of the basic way to calculate a footprint, and following these ISO guidelines, there's a lot of flexibility. So it doesn't quite guarantee consistent comparisons. A great place to start, but still allows for a lot of flexibility. Sort of the next level of ensuring comparability is to use carbon footprint standards. And these are international standards that various organizations have written. They're all similar. These are the three main ones right now. There's a greenhouse gas protocol standard that was released by the World Resource Institute and the World Building Council for Sustainable Development. Out of the UK, there's a standard PASS 2050. And then ISO is also working on a specific carbon footprint standard, which is in draft form right now. So all of these standards add another level of rigor to how a life cycle assessment is calculated and begin to ensure more comparability. So if you're a manufacturer using one of these standards, in addition to the ISO standard for LCA, is a great place to start. And really, the gold standard in how you calculate a carbon footprint right now is what's called an environmental product declaration. And this really takes LCAs to the next level. They're sort of colloquially referred to as nutrition labels for building products. And you can see here sort of a mock nutrition label. But instead of carbohydrates and sugars and fats, you're getting environmental impacts, like, again, like global warming potential, the carbon footprint. But you're also getting other environmental impacts. This is a little simplistic. I think another way to think of an EPD is that it's a summary of an LCA. It's specifically written for the consumer, and it not only has those LCA results, but it also includes more information about the product. And the key thing to remember and what makes EPDs the gold standard are what are called product category rules. And these are really important and really the key to the how you calculate comparable carbon footprints. And what these rules do is they definitively set the methodology for how you conduct an LCA for a given product category. So it would say, okay, this is how you calculate a carbon footprint for carpet, and then all manufacturers can follow that same methodology, use that same PCR, and then the results are comparable. So this is really important if we want to make informed decisions. A few more technical things about EPDs. They're technically an eco-label, which means that they have to be third-party verified, which is another large benefit. And they follow a few additional standards. I've listed them at the bottom. I think where we're headed in the future is simplifying this process even more and making it so simple that a manufacturer could just go to one sort of portal, input their information, and then be generated, the back end would sort of generate an EPD and that carbon footprint for the manufacturer. We're not there yet. Right now, really, the gold standard is still to go out and conduct an EPD. But maybe in the next 5 years, you'll begin to see more software available that simplifies this process even further and really ensures complete comparability by standardizing everything. So that's one of the main things that needs to be calculated. The other big calculation piece is the benchmark and the baseline. So we can really begin to know, okay, yes, this product achieves this reduction. And again, the key to the benchmark is that product category rule, maintaining the exact same methodology. And the way we see this working is that average EPD or generic EPD could be created for a product category. So using average data for that product and then following the same methodology of the PCR would give you sort of an average for that industry, and that could really set the benchmark with the results. And then any product that was evaluated according to that same PCR, then that methodology would be consistent, and then you could begin to make informed decisions about the reduction of a given product. So this first step of calculation is really where we are today. We're beginning to see more manufacturers calculate their carbon footprints, begin to start doing LCAs, and really reach for that gold standard and conduct EPDs. I've listed a few of the manufacturers that are doing that today. And this is where most of the activity within this field of carbon footprinting is occurring. the next big step is communicating this information, communicating the impact, the carbon impact of a product in a consistent and transparent manner to the consumers of this information, the architects, the specifiers, and the contractors. At the broadest scale, the EPD itself provides sort of the overview information. And I'm just going to work through this next step for EPDs, since that's our goal and that's what we're shooting for. And like I mentioned before, the EPD is really a summary of the LCA. So it'll give you the results, it'll give you that carbon impact, but it'll also give you a lot of other information about how the EPD was conducted, information about the product, who verified this, who third-party verified this particular EPD, and information about the manufacturer. So it's very broad overview, and it's really valuable for those consumers who want to dig deep into the information and have time to do so. Right now, the EPDs that do exist out there are owned by the manufacturer, and they're hosted by the third party that develops these documents, what are called EPD program operators. And I've listed the four main program operators in the U.S. Right now, the best way to find an EPD is to contact one of these program operators and see what manufacturers they've calculated EPDs for. I think there's also incredible value in simplifying and boiling down an EPD into just the basics. And so this is the next sort of tier of information. There's an EPD program operator out of Europe that makes what are called climate declarations, and these are just a one-pager about that carbon impact, that carbon footprint of a product. So it summarizes the carbon aspect of the EPD into a really consistent, easy, quick thing for a specifier who doesn't necessarily have time to really read a longer document. So there's incredible value in boiling it down. I think that's an exciting example. In the U.S., UL Environment, which is one of the current program operators, has also experimented with something similar. They've created what's called a transparency brief, which is just a two-page summary of sort of the entire EPD. And I'm not aware of anyone who's done this yet, but there's also people playing around with the idea of, again, just turning that EPD into a nutrition label of sorts that could be on packaging or available at other points of sale. So this next tier is really valuable to people who don't have enough time but still need to find out the impact of a product but maybe don't have enough time to really go through the whole EPD. And then finally, the next tier of information is just that carbon footprint. The value, again, this much carbon over the lifetime of the product. And this is this is information that's going to be important in specifications and databases and allow for searching by a given reduction. So the important thing to know is that how we communicate this information is critical. It's still sort of in development. The best place right now is an EPD, but you're beginning to see more people experiment with different ways of communicating this information. And I think this step will particularly evolve a lot over the coming years. And then sort of the other piece to this is putting all of this information into databases and product selection tools. So we've actually, we're working with Green Wizard to incorporate the benchmarks and the reduction targets into their platform. And we've also had a few brief conversations with Building Green and Healthy Building Network about expanding and including attributes for EPDs and carbon footprints in their projects. And then there are a few organizations as well who are working on incorporating EPDs into BIM software. So you'll also begin to see more databases have these attributes and options to search for carbon footprints, to search for EPDs. Once we have all of this information, the third step is to specify low-carbon products that have low-carbon footprints. And we're going to see this come at two parts in the specifications. The first is in the submittals, where specifiers are going to be requesting that manufacturers submit an EPD that complies with the relevant ISO standard. And then the second aspect is going to be in the performance criteria per product, where specifiers will be asking that the product meets a certain carbon footprint or meets a reduction from a benchmark, and ensures that, and the specifications will also ensure that the product category rules are the same for the product and the benchmark. This is all still in development as well, again, because most manufacturers are still at that calculating stage. So there's not a wealth of information that specifiers can use. But this is just kind of gives you a taste of what's coming in the next 2 to 5 years. And then finally, the specifications will drive the purchasing of low-carbon products, which will just add to the demand for transparent low-carbon products and incentivize additional manufacturers to calculate their carbon footprints, achieve the reductions, and really promote the whole idea of low-carbon building products. And it's important to know that this system is not really linear. It really does all influence each other. It's very early. We launched this challenge in 2011, and the field of carbon footprinting itself is still pretty young. And so it's an exciting time to be involved in this and to be leading manufacturer, figuring out, okay, how to best calculate your carbon footprint, how to best communicate this. But it's all still very much in development. And the most important thing right now is to start somewhere. If you're a manufacturer, develop an LCA. Begin to understand the impacts of your product. Work with your industry to set that standard methodology, to set the PCR and agree to sort of the industry benchmark. And then if there are PCRs out there, if you develop a PCR, really go for that full gold standard. Go for that EPD. And then use all of this information to begin to reduce your impact. If you're an architect or a specifier, you can begin to request information from manufacturers. Let them know that you're concerned about this issue. You want to begin to reduce the carbon impact from building products. And then as this field evolves, as more manufacturers develop EPDs, as the communication tools become more developed, really stay informed. And that's really one of our main goals at Architecture 2030 is to provide that information so that you know where to look and what to look for. And then finally, there's also a great need for third-party supporters to get involved to provide technical expertise, education and awareness, and really work on developing sort of the tools that are going to grease the wheels, the communication tools, how do we successfully communicate this information, draft specifications, all of the little pieces that complete the system. I do want to mention a few other initiatives that are also sort of driving the building and product sphere towards the use of EPDs. One of the main ones is LEED. LEED version 4 has proposed materials and resources credit called Materials Disclosure and Optimization. And that will begin to award credits for the use of products that have EPDs. LEED has been playing around with a few different pilot credits for how to incorporate EPDs, but it looks like whatever version of LEED 4 finally is approved will definitely include incentives for the use of EPDs. Another initiative coming out of the U.S. federal government was an executive order to purchase low-carbon products, so for the government agencies and suppliers to purchase low-carbon products. They still haven't finalized the rules for how this will work, but it will definitely be based on LCAs and probably resemble something along the lines of the EPDs because of, again, that comparability factor. EPDs originally originated in Europe, and there's great momentum by various countries and the European Union to figure out the best way to use EPDs. One particular initiative I want to mention is out of France, where they've actually mandated the use of EPDs on all products. This is still in a pilot phase for the next 2 years, but they're working with a large number of manufacturers to figure out how best to do this. And there's a potential scenario in France and also in Europe in which if you wanted to be part of that market, if you wanted to sell products, you would have to have an EPD. So something, again, to be kind of aware of. And then another really big driver is the entire movement towards transparency. If you tuned in to the webinar yesterday, you had a great overview of sort of all the different transparency movements, but there's definitely incentives for manufacturers to disclose this information, and architects and specifiers are beginning to want to know what's in your product, what's the impact of the product. So there's a large movement in transparency in general, not just for the carbon footprint, which is, of course, one part of it. So before wrapping up, I kind of want to end on a really exciting example of how the 2030 Challenge for Products, how we see it working, and this is in the concrete industry. Concrete is by far the building product that has the largest carbon footprint. Globally, it represents 5 to 6% of total CO2 emissions. And it's also a heavily used, widely used product. It's great for, large buildings and provides a lot of structural support. But it's also an important environmental product if you're going to be doing passive heating and cooling for its properties as a thermal mass. Within the concrete industry, there were a few early leaders who conducted those initial life cycle assessments, began to understand the impacts of their product and their supply chain. And what they discovered, the hot spots for concrete are, one, the cement consumption, the non-renewable energy at the plant, and then the transportation of the concrete to the construction site. So they identified these as the three hot spots, and then they began to implement policies and innovations that would begin to reduce the impact of concrete at these areas. So there were some initial movements, some early leaders in the field. There was also great leadership at the industry level. The National Ready Mix Concrete Association issued these sustainability initiatives, which built off of the earlier work of those initial LCAs, and set sort of these wide goals for concrete producers as a whole, including reducing the embodied energy and the carbon footprint of these plants by 30% by 2030. So there was initial momentum towards reducing the carbon footprint, and what was really missing was that standard methodology. How do we actually calculate the carbon footprint? How do we make it comparable? And a group out of the University of Washington, the Carbon Leadership Forum, began to lead an initiative to write the product category rules for concrete. This initiative has been going on for about a year and a half now, and the concrete PCRs just went through their second public comment period and will be released in November. So we're coming up to sort of a big announcement on this end. And what's really important about this initiative out of the Carbon Leadership Forum is that they put together an incredibly transparent and collaborative process to write these rules. It involved not only the industry, but also leading researchers in the field of concrete, environmental organizations, architects, and academia, and really provided a great group of stakeholders to write strong, robust rules. And it has the buy-in from the concrete industry as well. Once these rules are released, then the program operators can begin to develop EPDs for concrete producers. And that will allow for producers to understand the impact of their various mix designs and make informed decisions about low-carbon products. It'll allow for a benchmark to be set for concrete, and then it'll really push the reductions and allow specifiers to use this information to specify low-carbon concrete. So this is an initiative that's been heating up a lot, specifically over the next few months, and if you're interested in how it develops, I would highly encourage you to stay tuned over the coming months for some exciting announcements. So that's sort of a pilot, an example of how other industries can get involved, how other manufacturers can get involved into beginning to set the consistent PCRs and move this initiative forward. These are all of the adopters and supporters that we're currently working with on the 2030 Challenge for Products. And you can see they cover a wide range of manufacturers as well as architects and designers and the third parties and supporters. If you're interested in learning more about the challenge, I would recommend you visit our website where you can sign up for our e-news bulletin and find out more about how this initiative evolves and our other initiatives. Like I said before, I've focused on the product side, but we do a lot with buildings and cities as well. You can also adopt and support the challenge, and on our website, you can find additional resources to learn more about the technical details. And one such resource that I highly recommend is an information hub that we put together with Building Green and the Healthy Building Network. And that's the end of my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Excellent. Thank you, Francesca. We do have a few questions for you. The first question is about EPDs and how significant investment in time and money is it to do an EPD? Do you know an average cost per product to do an EPD?
You know, there's a wide range, but I will say that right now it is pretty expensive. I think the range is anywhere between like $20,000 to $60,000, depending on obviously the manufacturer and the number of products and such. And this is one of the key stumbling blocks right now to EPDs is that they are quite expensive for manufacturers. And I think, as I mentioned before, where we see this going is a scenario in which manufacturers don't have to go through the current process of a program operator and lots of a few months in terms of developing it and then having it verified. And what they'll be able to do is just go to a portal, input their information, and within a matter of days or weeks, get that EPD. But I think what's missing is a critical volume. Right now, there are a handful of manufacturers, a handful of program operators. There really needs to be more volume of interested parties. And that's sort of where the concrete PCR comes into play. The National Ready Mixed Concrete Association is going, actually, they announced that they're a program operator for concrete producers. And one of their goals is to set up such a system for their producers. So the producer could just go to this tool, input their plant-specific, their mix-specific information, and then easily have access to an EPD.
Another question for you. Who oversees the product category rule development process?
So this is one of those, like, Wild West aspects of the challenge. And of carbon footprinting as a whole. In theory, the EPD program operators oversee it, and in order for an EPD to become official, it has to be accepted, it has to be approved by an EPD program operator. But the process of writing the PCR can be written, it can be led by various different initiatives. There are PCRs that are being written right now that are being led by industry, being led by one or two manufacturers, being led by an academic group, as in the case of sort of the Carbon Leadership Forum. So that's still very much sort of in development. We recommend that the industry really take a key role in how it's developed. They obviously know their product the best. And then with their buy-in, you can end up with strong PCRs. One of the key rules about developing a PCR is that it has to be a collaborative process. So it can't just be the industry. It has to be environmental groups, experts, and it has to be a transparent, open process. But in terms of who leads it, it really depends on who wants to on some level.
Another question for you. Many clients have opted out of LEED certification because of the additional cost. What is the 2030 challenges approach to overcoming this?
So we've left it open in terms of, for now, because there are so few LCAs and EPDs out there, a manufacturer can adopt the challenge through either an LCA or an EPD, and an LCA is not quite as expensive as an EPD. So we can begin to build manufacturers who are going out and conducting this kind of information.
I guess for some clarity, the 2030 challenge is not a certification in the way that LEED is a certification.
No. Oh, yeah, sorry. So not actually the cost of conducting the information. Yeah. All of our challenges are voluntary. We really see our role as setting the big picture vision and the big picture agenda and those final targets that we're reaching for, and then encouraging and supporting our adopters however they need the support to meet these challenges.
Okay. So you said that concrete is one of the products that has an especially large footprint. What are some of the other products that intrinsically have a large footprint? So if designers specifically wanted to focus on that, those categories, they can.
Sure. The other big ones are metals, like steel, aluminum. Gypsum board also has a fairly large footprint. And then after that, they all become pretty similar, and it depends more on the amount that you're putting into your building.
I have one more question for you on the impact of transportation. So is that generally calculated into an EPD, or is that, because since it's variable, is that something that's left out of the equation?
So that's usually calculated in an EPD, particularly the transportation of the raw resources to the manufacturing site. That's definitely going to be in the EPD. Some EPDs do not take into consideration the transportation to the site.
Okay.
But it really depends on who's writing the product category rule and the product. Like some products, it's easy, but variability is smaller, whereas some products, it becomes prohibitively more difficult, and so the product writer, the PCR writer, might choose to opt out of that.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time and for the information.